Hello and welcome to a special edition of the America Magazine podcast. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Austin Ivory, author of the new book, The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope. Welcome, Austin. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
There's many things we can talk about here. This is a very interesting, fills in a lot of holes and background on the life of Francis that people, I think, are really interested in. But maybe we can start with Argentina and the political scene there. Our reviewer, Peter Steinfeld, cited your book as a really helpful background on that piece of that part of Jorge Bergoglio's life. Maybe you can, if you can, summarize the various political forces at play in Argentina during his youth and also his time as a young priest.
Many years ago, 23 years ago, I did my doctorate on the church and politics in Argentina. So, you know, I'm walking proof that PhDs can be useful. And of course, when he came out onto the balcony that night on March 13th, I thought, actually, I think I understand this man, even though I hadn't any contact with him in the intervening period. He did strike me as very, very Argentine, and an Argentine of a particular kind and a particular generation. What I hope to bring out in the book is that Argentina really has its own culture war. There is, if you like, liberals versus nationalists. And the nationalist tradition, which is the one that Jorge Mario Bergoglio very, very clearly identifies with, was the culture particularly of the children of recently arrived immigrants in the early 20th century. His own parents came from Italy in the late 20s. So he grew up very much in that environment, which would later produce Perón. So it was Juan Domingo Perón who drew on these Catholic nationalist values in opposition to, if you like, the liberal elite of the time. So I think that was all you know, important background, because that's who he identifies with, the ordinary people. That's why he's naturally, if you like, a Peronist. Doesn't mean he's identified with the political movement, but comes out of that. And then he grew up as at the time of Perón, and then as a young Jesuit in the 1950s, was a time of immense political crisis in Argentina, where Peronism was excluded from power, even though it remained the most popular party. And we have a series of unstable governments, which then culminate with the rise of actually the Western Hemisphere's largest guerrilla at the time, dominated by the Montoneros, who drew on many Catholic, no, same national Catholic roots. And then, of course, that was followed by the ferocious dictatorship and the dirty war. And that was the period when he was a provincial. So he grows up in a divided country that's divided politically, and most importantly, in which the church is, if you like, on both sides of that divide.
You mentioned his time as provincial. This is an interesting point from our point of view of, obviously, Jesuit Magazine. This was something that people were unclear of when he was elected. What role, you know, why was he a provincial at such a young age? He seemed to be a divisive figure. Can you shed some light on some of those questions?
I think what this, what the Great Reformer does, you know, new, that's new in the rapidly increasing number of biographies about Pope Francis, is I really dig into the Jesuit part of his life. And when I went out there, one thing I really wanted to do, I was convinced actually that if I could understand, as it were, what had gone wrong between this very successful provincial and the Society of Jesus, then, you know, we would understand much more about the man. And I think I do provide that account for the first time of the causes of the misunderstandings and the breakdown. But I mean, it's worth saying, you know, he was only 36 when he became provincial. The previous provincial had to stand down early because the province was in crisis. Vocations had collapsed. There were many Jesuits who were leaving. And there really was just a massive crisis over the identity of the Jesuits following the council. This was a dispute over the version of renewal that was provoked by the council. And he took over in order, in a way, to restore order, to reign back, to provide a focus and an anchor, and to unite a very divided province, and of course to attract vocations again. He did that, and he was immensely successful. And I have the statistics of vocations, and it's quite remarkable how over the next 10 years, as provincial and then as rector, the province started filling up again to such an extent that, in fact, in Rome they were saying, what's his secret? Because this was at a time, of course, of collapsing vocations worldwide. So now, how does he do it? And this is what, you know, I've called him the Great Reformer because consistently he's been put in positions of church leadership and he's carried out these reforms, which are based on, I think, an idea of, we can talk about this in a minute, but spiritual discernment, Yves Congar and all the rest of it. But here's the point. He takes over a divided province and he unites the province by refocusing the Jesuits on the poor and on the mission of the ordinary faithful people. He uses an expression, God's holy faithful people, el santo pueblo fiel de Dios. He says that's where we need to be as Jesuits. And so he sought to detach them, if you like, from ideology and to root them in the mission to the ordinary faithful people and to respect their values and of the ordinary people. And that's what ultimately becomes controversial in the province, because some of the elder, if you like, more progressive, more intellectual Jesuits balked at this. They felt that this was not Jesuit. This was, they accused him of Silesianizing the province, because he had been he'd grown up with Silesians. And so they said, this is not very Jesuit. And that was the source of the controversy.
That's very interesting. And we were just talking earlier that you feel like the really one of the central chapters here is the leader expelled 1980 to 1992. So you touch a bit about the divisions there, but maybe you can talk more about that period in his life.
So, that chapter charts the breakdown. It took place over quite a long period. So he was rector, he was provincial, then he was rector of the Collegio Maximo. Even when he stood down as provincial, he remained, as one Jesuit put it to me, a provincial without portfolio, an immensely influential figure in the society. Now, a number of Jesuits said to me, the whole point about, when a Jesuit's given a position of responsibility like rector or provincial, he steps down after 6 years and he's supposed to kind of melt back into the background, right? And you've got a real problem when actually, he steps down and remains as influential as before. So there is actually then, what happens is that there's a very deliberate attempt from Rome after the new general, Peter Hans Kolvenbach, takes over in 1983. He's persuaded by this group of Jesuit intellectuals who have taken against Bergoglio. He's persuaded to intervene in the province and basically to displace Bergoglio's people and to introduce a new model of formation. And here's where it began to get very, very tense, because basically the young Jesuits who adored Bergoglio, who were actually deeply persuaded by his model of being a Jesuit, which was very much based actually on the primitive Society of Jesus, they resented deeply this. They resented the new provincial government. So you have the province of Argentina enters into a very tense period, which actually lasts a number of years, in which there's growing tension. And I think, to put this very simply, what happens is they end up deciding that the Bergoglio's presence is the problem. So he is scapegoated, I think there's no other way of putting it, and he is exiled. He's subject to this internal exile, which was really a brutal thing, in which a two-year period in which he suffered enormously. He was sent to Cordoba, as is well known. And then after that, as is well known, he then is made an auxiliary bishop. So that was actually the culmination of a process that actually lasted from 1986 all the way through to 1990. Those 4 years were the years of enormous tension within the province, and to this day Argentine Jesuits are, if you like, still reluctant to go into too many details about it, because as with any family dispute, blood got spilt on both sides.
Well, we were just talking earlier about the so-called black legend about Bergoglio, and which contributed to the reaction in this country when he was elected in some Jesuit houses, where a lot of people were very wary of him, and that's the background there.
Well, and I hope the Great Reformer does a lot to heal some of these wounds, but also for a lot of Jesuits to realize actually what did happen and that they did get him wrong, and that this black legend, one of the things I want to do in the book is to trace why is it that when Francis was elected, there was this kind of collective groan went up from Jesuit houses across the world, and they said, but on the basis of what knowledge? On the basis of a myth which had grown and metastasized over time. Now, what was that myth? Where did it come from? How did it grow in the way it does? Well, you've got to read the book. But it has everything to do with not just the story I've been recounting, but also, of course, the traumatic story of the dirty war, of the dictatorship, and the way that was subsequently viewed in the 1980s. I'm convinced that the politicization of the issue of the church's role in the dirty war in the 1980s became actually crucial to the development of the black legend. And actually, in the late 70s, the people who would later accuse him of having been complicit and all the rest of it, they weren't making the accusation then, they made it subsequently.
Right, and that contributed to the stories that came out when he was elected about, who was this guy? What was his involvement in these dirty wars? But you and other biographers have basically absolved him of those charges.
Well, the specific charges which circulated after his election, that in some way he encouraged or allowed or gave a green light to the military to abduct these two Jesuits, has been shown so often to be baseless. As I say, what interested me in the book was not, are we going to go over that old ground and establish his innocence? I was much more interested in where did the accusation come from? Why did it take wing? Why did it last so long? And that's really what I'm doing in the book.
And another motif, or at least theme that's been focused upon by other biographers, is this time in Cordoba as perhaps a time of some sort of conversion. But that doesn't seem to be the way you're looking at it. That
no, so I mean the book which many in the English speaking world, the biography that many people are familiar with is Paul Vallely's Pope Francis Untying the Knots, a compatriot of mine, and I know Paul, and it, he read it very quickly, and he went to Buenos Aires and talked to various people and pulled together this account, which I think, you know, even in according to his own text, isn't substantiated by evidence. It's more like a supposition. He takes as read the accusation that Bergoglio was a conservative. And then he tries to reconcile that with, as it were, the Bergoglio, the bishop, who was clearly a man identified with the poor and so on. And he, as it were, explains this but with the confession. Well, he wasn't a conservative before, and he didn't become a kind of progressive afterwards. There is a continuity there. I've read, you know, everything Jorge Mario Bergoglio wrote as a Jesuit. Rather amazingly, if I can just say parenthetically, I arrived in Cordoba and I said, where are all these articles which I know he wrote in the spirituality journals? And I assumed that they had been published, you know, in new editions since he'd become a pope. And they said they would richly bring down these tomes from the shelves and blow dust off them and say, here they are. And I went, I had to go and photocopy them because they were long since out of print. No other biographer had actually looked at these tomes containing all his writings. I don't see any conversion, any evidence, and those people who know him well also dispute that thesis. I'm not saying that Cordoba didn't have an effect on him. It did. It softened him. It was a crucifying. It was an experience of very intense suffering. Some very beautiful spiritual writings, which I go into in my account of his Cordoba exile. He has one absolutely extraordinary article, which I'm amazed has not been picked up before. But it begins by saying, these are some reflections on a religious order which is suffering a difficult period. Now, it's so obviously the Society of Jesus. It's just glaringly obvious. And what follows is an absolutely magnificent, beautiful spiritual discernment of the way, you know, that you can have a breakdown within a religious order. But it's basically based on the exercises and the idea, you know, of the hidden Christ and so on. So it was a period of a very profound period of me. I don't think there's a bit of a myth about Cordoba that he was, you know, that he was cut off from people. He was cut off in the sense that the people who were very close to him were told, you know, not to have contact with him. But in fact, he gave retreats in this period, and he gave two amazing retreats to a huge number of clergy in La Plata province and so on. So, I mean, he wasn't, as it were, a hermit, but it was a very, very trying period for him in which he was displaced. He was removed from not just from positions of influence within the province, but, you know, he was isolated in terms of the province. And what was even more painful to him was that he had to watch what he had built up being undone.
Now, I think what so many people are attracted to Francis about is his personality, which is he is such a mature Christian. He's obviously gone through this long journey. He's really, I think people have said sort of a spiritual genius that people are attracted to. Is that period of suffering that he went through in Cordoba, does that help explain who he is today?
Well, I don't think it's those 2 years in Cordoba which He what he undergoes there is very profound, and his meditations on it are very profound. But he was doing that before as well. Mm. I mean, to understand, I've been saying, you know, John Paul II was a philosopher, Benedict XVI was a theologian. What is Francis? Francis is a spiritual master. That's him. You know, he was a brilliant spiritual director. He was a brilliant retreat giver. The Jesuits today will remember his retreats, you know, with awe. And he was, you know, a master discerner. He really absorbed St. Ignatius's rules. That's present from the very beginning of his writings, and they continue beyond Cordoba as well. And yes, you're dealing with a man who has navigated the contours of the spirit, really understands Ignatius's discernment rules, understands the whole idea of the good spirit appearing, the bad spirit appearing, sometimes sub angelo lucis, in the guise of an angel. Sometimes you have to find out what that is by, you know, you only see the serpent's tail. That expression, the serpent's tail, appears very often in his writing. So he's constantly discerning, and that's what he's doing now as Pope. So you want to know how he governs the Catholic Church. It's every morning at 4:30 in the morning, there he is, deep in prayer, meditating, discerning spirits. That's when he takes his big decisions. And he genuinely does govern, and always did as a Jesuit and as an archbishop, according to that discernment and his perception of God's will. And that's why he's a radical.
Now, are these the qualities that kind of brought him to the attention of the international church, you know, when the time came as he rose up the ranks bishop, archbishop, and then cardinal?
It's a really, really interesting story, which again is told in this book for the first time, which surprised me. I didn't know this story, and I almost stumbled across it. And when I came across it, I got quite excited because it demonstrates a kind of a continuity between Benedict and Francis, which I think has not been perceived. But let me try and put it simply. Bergoglio was part of a group of Latin American nationalists, if I can put it that way, who believed that Latin America was coming into a stage where it was going to be the source for the universal church. So if Europe had been the source for the universal church, of course, for the previous few hundred years, if you think, you know, France and Germany at the time of the Second Vatican Council, or Spain and Italy at the time of Council of Trent, Latin America was emerging as the source of the church. Now, the person who spotted this, in fact, was Cardinal Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict, who actually nurtured this and encouraged that great meeting at Aparecida in 2007, in which Bergoglio emerges, really, I would say, as the Latin American continental leader. Now, there's a very dramatic moment in 2005 when, you know, there's a group of cardinals that want him to be Pope. He's seen as a kind of pastoral, collegial alternative to Ratzinger, and he puts a stop to it very dramatically. He tells the cardinals not to vote for him. And in interviews, I've been able to unpack the fact that really he believed that his time had not come, but more to the point, the Latin American church's time had not come. And so that's, you know, this is the spiritual discerner at play. He really did believe that was the wrong time, that there would be a time. So what you see between 2005 and 2013 is the Latin American church emerging and taking its place, that magnificent document of Aparecida, which of course is now the program for the universal church. Bergoglio has a key role in its redaction. He's seen as the continental leader. Now, I'm not saying that he goes to Rome expecting to be made Pope, or indeed necessarily anybody thinking that he would be Pope. But nonetheless, there was that sense, I would say, of expectation. And that the same group of cardinals who wanted to elect him in 2005, this time seized their opportunity, saw that this time, you know, the time was ripe, that he wouldn't resist his election. And you know, they and I'm looking for the right word here, they helped to suggest that he would make a great pope energetically, let's say. And because the difference, big difference in 2005 and 2013 was that the curial cardinals, the Vatican cardinals, who normally basically stitch up the conclave, as I put it, both needle and thread had slipped from their hands, and these North European reformist cardinals seized their moment. And of course the Latin American cardinals were already behind Bergoglio, and that roughly is the story of the 2013 conclave.
Right, and we should bring up that there has been, you've been in the news in the last week, with some pushback against the narrative you present here, suggesting that there was a campaign of some sort among the cardinals to elect Bergoglio, and specifically that he consented ahead of time to the plan. Now, that, there's one correction you've made to that narrative, yes?
Well, I never say in the book that he consented to any of this. What I do have in the book, and it's at the top of page 355, is that they sought his consent. And I regret writing that, because that appears to suggest, or has been interpreted as suggesting, that they actually went to him and, you know, said to him, look, is it all right if we push for you to be Pope? They never did that, and I didn't mean to suggest that they did. I was trying to draw a contrast with 2005, this time to say that he wouldn't believe that he wouldn't resist his election. Now, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, who I ought to say is my old boss, and was very helpful, of course, in with this book and so on, wanted to make clear, and he has done in a statement, that they never did go to him to say, would you be willing to participate in this? And I've been happy to make clear in a statement, and I've apologized for it, and I've been very happy to say that he did not in any way participate in this process. Why is all this important? Well, there's sensitivity around the rules governing a conclave, and, you know, deals and so on and agreements prior to the conclaves are forbidden by the rules. I didn't find any evidence that any conclave rules had been broken. All that happened was there was a group of cardinals who were basically keen on Bergoglio and who went round, you know, saying we think he would make a great pope. That is perfectly normal. It happens before every conclave. It happened in 2005 when there was a group of cardinals urging Joseph Ratzinger's election. I'm confident that my account is accurate, but I regret that one line, which has already been corrected in the e-book edition.
In the e-book. All right. Well, that's good to know. Maybe we can end with one question. You just mentioned what, you know, you talked about Francis as a radical pope. I wonder if that's a description he would accept, given the fact that he is, you know, stressed the continuity with some of his predecessors. Of course, he canonized St. John Paul II and also John the 23rd. Would you think he would consider himself a radical Pope?
Well, he said so, actually. I mean, he was asked by a journalist, La Vanguardia, a Spanish newspaper, are you a revolutionary? And he said, for him, the real revolution is the person who goes to the root, which is, of course, the meaning of radical. Right. I'm confident that he would not. Just by the way, anecdotally, I was in Rome very recently, and I was able to present the book to the Holy Father, and it was a wonderful moment. But later in the day, I bumped into Cardinal Casper, and I gave him a copy of the book. I happened to have one with me. And he was delighted. He said, yes, you are right. He is not a liberal. He is not a conservative. He is a radical. So I'm fairly confident about this, you know, that I'm on the... I agree with Cardinal Casper. He's not a liberal. And I think liberals need to realize, you know, he's not going to liberalize church doctrine. But he's obviously not a conservative either. He's a radical in the tradition of church reform. And I hope one of the great things that if the book contributes to understanding what that reform is, then I think I'll be very happy as a writer that I've been able to illuminate this, because I think it is at the moment misunderstood. I have discovered in these writings and in things here, from the very beginning, there is a discernment between true and false reform, very much influenced by Yves Congar's famous 1950 text of that title. Why is it that some reforms in the church go wrong and end up in division and schism, and others produce more unity and holiness? He dedicated himself both intellectually and practically to working that question out. And he started a thesis, Guardini, Mola, and so on. He applied, he never finished the thesis, but he put it into practice in his leadership of the church and also in his vision for the renewal of politics. And this is Francis's great contribution. He is a brilliant reformer. He understands reform, to an extraordinary degree. And that is why, even though it will be necessarily a short pontificate by virtue of his age, I believe, we don't have time to go into what he's changing, but I believe that the changes that he's initiating, not just in the Vatican, but in a kind of much deeper and wider sense, will shape the church of the next generation and will, in a very large extent, influence the papacies to come. And that's why I'm confident in calling him a great reformer.
Well, that's a great place to end. We want to thank Austin Ivey for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Tim.